From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Renee Bodley, filling in for Chris Cherniak today.
Thanks for joining us, Renee.
Glad to be here.
Today, we will be speaking with Cheryl Carter, the co-director of NRDC's energy program, about the future of clean and renewable energy here in the United States. Though the politics of the next 4 years don't promise to be particularly encouraging for environmental policy and practice, Cheryl and the NRDC expect to see renewable energy sources continuing to grow and thrive. Cheryl will explain why.
During the second half of the show, we've got a very topical topic. We'll be speaking with David Nimkins, Senior Regional Director for the Southwest Region of National Parks Conservation Association. As we all know, on December 28th, President Obama declared the Bears Ears National Monument here in Utah. David will bring us a look at the history of the efforts to protect this special area and what we can expect to see next.
Remember, we don't take phone calls during the show, but you can join in on today's discussion by posting your comments and questions to our Facebook page, KPCW This Green Earth. Our connections with and impacts upon the environment. That's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay tuned.
This is Allison Kulo with the Park City Chamber Bureau. Joining the Chamber Bureau provides your business with benefits, from lodging projections, educational videos, group sales leads, and a listing on the top travel site for Park City, and much more. Becoming a member of the Park City Chamber Bureau is a great investment for your business. Information on joining can be found at visitparkcity.com or call us at 649-6100. The Park City Chamber Bureau is a nonprofit organization and KPCW supporter.
This is Chris Robinson with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. KPCW is one of the many nonprofits our agents and company support. They are the backbone of Summit and Wasatch counties in our incredible community. More info at bhhsutah.com.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson, and I'm here with Renee Bodley today. And joining us in the first half of the show is Cheryl Carter. She's the co-director of the Natural Resource Defense Council's Energy Program. Cheryl plays a key role at the NRDC by promoting the development and adoption of energy efficiency and other clean energy strategies to reduce the public health, environmental, and global warming impacts of our energy production and use, and to increase energy equity and affordability. Cheryl, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Cheryl, let's start with just some background on the NRDC. You're one of the nation's largest environmental advocacy groups. Is that right?
Yes, it is. We are located both in the United States as well as having offices in China and in India.
And first question I'd like to ask, what kind of response are you getting from your membership about this upcoming change in administration?
We're getting a lot of very positive response from our membership and support, great faith that we're going to be able to maintain the progress that we've made over the last several years on environment. It's very heartening to get this support and this faith.
Was the NRDC surprised at the results of the election in November?
Well, I think everybody was caught a little bit off guard.
And did you, as far as the NRDC's strategies, did you guys look at any kind of revamping of your efforts on Capitol Hill and what you're trying to do for the next 4 years and on behalf of the environment?
Well, I think there is certainly some shifting going on, but we also have to wait and see to a certain extent what the policies are going to be. I think that is pretty much up in the air. Nobody really knows for sure what kind of policy changes they're going to be. And, of course, for our work in the clean energy area, a lot of what happens happens really at the state, regional, and even city levels. So a lot of that is not going to change.
So as we mentioned in the introduction, you're the co-director of the energy program at the NRDC. So what is the specific role of your department, and what are your focuses?
Well, in the energy and transportation program really focuses on transforming our whole energy system that powers our buildings, our transportation sector, and our utilities from dirty fossil fuels to clean and efficient energy in order to strengthen our economy, increase equity, and, of course, our main goal is to reduce global warming pollution. To limit the effects of global warming.
I think that right now there's a lot of anxiety and fear about what the administration might bring to the environment over the next 4 years. But you recently wrote a blog post about how you see at least in the area of renewable energy and clean energy sources, you still see a really promising future there, and you don't expect things to do a U-turn. So let's talk a little bit about that. What is it that kind of leads you to that conclusion?
Well, as you say, I still have a great, I think we have a lot of cause for optimism, because the transition from fossil fuels to clean energy, like solar, wind, and energy efficiency, is really underway, based on some pretty solid economic, environmental, and customer demand trends that aren't going to change just because of one election. Basically, what you're looking at is clean energy is cheaper now, it's cleaner, and people really want it, including the Trump supporters.
Now, when you say that the clean energy or renewable energy is cheaper, give us an idea of the prices that we're looking at. How much cheaper, and what are those trends? Where are those trends heading?
Well, I think energy efficiency has always been cheaper than any form of generation. You're talking about the difference between 2 to 3 cents per kilowatt hour for your electricity versus anywhere from 5 to 10 to 11 cents per kilowatt hour. So it's very cost effective, and it's always been that way. But in the last few years, wind and solar energy costs have come down tremendously, to the extent that wind is actually the cheapest resource, the new resource out there, and solar energy has come down in price by about 82%.
Sure.
So that's very competitive with fossil fuel investments.
And Donald Trump says he's all about the bottom line. Have you seen anything from him about renewable energy, either while he was campaigning or since he's been elected?
Well, he said some things that cast some doubt on whether he thinks that renewable energy is cost effective. But I've got to think that that's because he hasn't really looked into the details on it. And, you know, I think the fact that utilities are increasingly investing in it and have spoken out and said that they're not planning on changing their long-term plans on investments in energy efficiency and in clean energy, as well as their plans to shut down coal plants, they're actually looking at the bottom line in real time, and they're not changing their plans. So I think that I've got to hope that once he starts looking at the real economics of this, he'll see that this is actually a good economic booster.
But do you think with people like Rex Tillerson and Scott Pruitt in his cabinet that that's a likelihood?
Well, I'm really hoping to look at that. But even if they don't, like I said, a lot of energy, the bulk of energy policy and the bulk of the decisions surrounding what the energy mix is really made at the state levels by state legislatures and by state utility commissions that regulate the utilities. So, and those, you know, those states are still moving forward to the transition from fossil fuels to cleaner energy.
So along the lines of, you know, thinking about Trump and the Trump administration, you highlighted something really interesting online that was surprising to me. A new survey by the Republican polling firm Public Opinion Strategies found that 75% of people who voted for Trump support action to accelerate the deployment and use of clean energy. That was really surprising to me. Was that surprising to you, Cheryl?
It actually wasn't, because it's very in line with a lot of the polls that we've been seeing over the last several years. This is really, when you talk to people, not politicians, but people, this is a very nonpartisan issue, and it should be. And clean energy, first of all, the fact that it's cheaper and it's good for the economy seems like a no-brainer no matter what party you're in. The fact that it's cleaner and is better for our public health, cleans up our air and our water, is something that people really like, and it brings down people's bills as well. And I think that's also being recognized by utilities out there. I've heard many utility CEOs being quoted, recognizing that their customers want them to invest in clean energy and energy efficiency. So no, it wasn't really that surprising to me.
Well, then there seems to be a big disconnect. If the polls are showing this, and this seems to be a bipartisan issue as far as public polling is concerned, yet when you look at the elected officials, especially here in the state of Utah, they are very much pro-extraction industry. Our congressman here who represents Summit County, Representative Rob Bishop, and the congressman who represents Wasatch County, Jason Chaffetz, they both seem to be on the side of energy and, oil extraction. So how does the NRDC play that pivotal role in illustrating public opinion versus public policy? How do we get these elected leaders to see what these polls are saying?
Well, I think that some recent work that we've done really highlights, I think, what might make a difference to these politicians. And first of all, let me just say that when people vote in elections, that, and especially this last election, even though they hold the views that they support the environment, they support clean energy, they want us to invest in it, they weren't necessarily voting on that issue. And so they definitely were not voting for dirty air and dirty water in this election. So I think that's important to note. But for the policymakers, I think that it's very important to note that clean energy is not only cheaper, brings down people's bills, but it creates more jobs. So we also did a recent study, Environmental Entrepreneurs, did that showed that energy efficiency accounts for nearly 1.9 million American jobs. So that's 10 times more than oil and gas drilling. It's 30 times more than coal mining. And looking at those numbers and looking at those jobs, I think that it's got to make some kind of a difference. And as a matter of fact, the jobs are increasing, and over this next year alone, they're expecting 245,000 more energy efficiency jobs out there. And that's a 13% growth rate in jobs. That's not something you see in many places, and you're certainly not seeing it in the fossil fuel industry.
Those are incredible numbers to hear, Cheryl. And how do we get the people in the coal and the mining and the oil industries, say, on the eastern part of the state of Utah, whose families have been doing that kind of work for generations, how do we get them to say, oh, eureka, I get to work on a wind farm now?
Yeah, well, and that's not necessarily going to be a direct transaction, and that's something that we really have to pay attention to. I think it's going to be very important to, find different, whether it be clean energy or some other kind of economic activity, to transition those regions into that it's more sustainable, because, you know, the coal industry is not going to be coming back for economic reasons, really, despite what our president-elect has intimated. And we need to really focus on finding new economic activity for those regions, no matter what we do moving forward.
So in terms of taking advantage of the economic possibilities of renewable energy, how does this look on an international setting? How is the U.S. doing now, and what potential do you see there in the future?
You mean in terms of our competitive ability?
Exactly. It seems that some countries, from my perspective, are jumping on the renewables bandwagon faster than the United States. And, you know, how do you expect to see that impact?
This is true. And you bring up a very good point. We are seeing many other countries having already jumped in with both feet, where I think we've, jumped in with maybe one and a half feet. And China being one of the biggest ones, which was surprising to me. Within the matter of just, 2 to 4 years, it's incredible how much their investment in renewables and energy efficiency has increased, really dwarfing what they're doing on fossil fuels. Now, obviously, they have a long way to go, but that's a very powerful economy. And we certainly don't want to get behind. That's one of the things that I'm concerned with. While the clean energy transition may continue, and it can only be delayed or slowed down by changes in federal policy, which is bad enough, it really could put us behind on international competitiveness. I mean, there are several countries that are banking on this being the next big thing.
Cheryl, question for you. When you mentioned that the coal industry isn't coming back, it made me think of a company like Murray Energy, which, used to own Crandall Canyon Mine. I know they did at the time of the collapse back in 2007 here in Utah. And Bob Murray, big supporter of Scott Pruitt, who is Trump's EPA pick, who's an Oklahoma attorney general. Obviously, the oil industry very big in Oklahoma. So companies like Murray Energy, I'm just using that as an example. Would we see an energy company decide we are in the business of being a utility and creating energy for the American public, and we're going to transition out of this old industry into a new industry? For example, we saw Rocky Mountain Power establish a huge solar farm in central Utah. Are you seeing any trends of energy companies kind of going with this new model, or is that just a ridiculous expectation to make of someone who used to mine coal to say we're now going to be a solar farm provider?
Well, it's not out of the realm of possibility, but and we have seen oil companies, for example, like BP, start investing in solar energy, for example, and starting to diversify their investments in other areas. I don't know that we've seen it with coal companies. I don't know that we will. But you had mentioned utility, and I think utilities are certainly moving in this direction. And, you know, they provide a service to customers, and so it's not as important to them whether they're buying coal or whether they're buying wind power in terms of the service that they provide to their customers. So that's a much easier switch for them to make, and they've been doing it. With a coal mining company, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'm wondering if they own the land or if they have the rights to the land, if they might consider that putting up big windmills or solar panels would be a better use of that land. If that's the way the public wants them to go, it might be beneficial for them. Just speculation.
Yeah, I definitely think they should be thinking along those lines.
So actually, if you're just joining us, we're speaking with Cheryl Carter, who's the co-director of the Natural Resource Defense Council's Energy Program. And we're talking about the future of clean and renewable energy here in the United States, in particular during the next 4 years with this change of administration. So you mentioned that state policy is in large part what drives energy development and energy plans. Where might the federal policy impact that?
Well, federal policy can certainly slow down or delay or maybe cut off certain avenues to states. But for the most part, our energy industry and certainly the utilities are primarily regulated at the state level. So, doing things state by state rather than having, for example, a federal energy efficiency standard is much less effective. And as a matter of fact, that's why we have federal energy efficiency standards, because various states were setting efficiency standards and companies didn't like the patchwork and went to the federal government. If they start, putting blocks on federal policies, then, I think states still have a lot of avenues open to them. The utilities can decide under the regulation, of course, with public utility commissions, what resources they invest in, and more states, as I mentioned, are going the route of clean energy. There are 29 states plus the District of Columbia that have state-level renewable energy standards. One out of five Americans already live in a state with a 50% renewable energy target. That's something that really surprised me over this last year. States are going to be able to continue to set those kinds of standards and those kinds of goals for their utilities. Like I said, I think the federal policies could delay or slow progress, but they can't stop it. But they can certainly, as you mentioned before, they can hinder our competitiveness, not just domestically, but certainly internationally.
Are you familiar with anything in Scott Pruitt's history in Oklahoma regarding his stance on energy policy when he was Attorney General in Oklahoma?
I am not familiar with anything specific, although I know that we're certainly looking into it.
So one thing that I wanted to talk a little bit about was, you know, you mentioned utility companies have been amongst the most important players in advancing, you know, renewable energy. And that in Illinois, Exelon was just instrumental in actually passing some of this policy. So are you seeing that happen in other places? Was this an anomaly?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, we had some at the end of the year after the elections. In addition to Illinois, we also had Republicans and Democrats in both Michigan and Ohio coming together to either pass or defend sweeping clean energy legislation that is set to accelerate, you know, renewable investments and increase energy efficiency in those states. So, and that's since the election. So it's that shows, I think, that you know, things aren't necessarily changing at the state level.
Well, we have a couple more minutes, and we have to wrap up. But I want to take a minute to talk about what people can do if they're interested in getting involved in this kind of policy work or energy, renewable energy work.
Well, one thing they can do, of course, is to visit NRDC's website, where we are keeping folks up to date on what the various threats are, what people can do in response, what we're doing in response. I think that is, you know, one thing that they can do. And certainly getting involved, speaking out, and making some changes themselves in terms of investments in energy efficiency, supporting their state policies. I think state and local government policies are going to be more important than they ever have been moving forward. So getting involved at that level, I think, is going to be really important as well.
And I went to your website just now when you were talking about that, Cheryl, and on the very front page, at least on the mobile application of your website, it's very big. Speak out. Tell your senators to vote no on Donald Trump's cabinet of polluters. And there's a red button there that says take action. So that tells me that's the NRDC's priority at the moment.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. That's the first priority. And then, of course, from day one, I think there are going to be attempts to roll a lot of things back. And we're going to be there for that as well.
And our listeners can, of course, find your blog as well, linked to the NRDC website. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Well, Cheryl Carter, co-director of the Natural Resource Defense Council's Energy Program, thanks so much for joining us today.
And Mel and Renee, thanks so much for having me.
Have a good day.
You too.
Well, with that, we're going to take a quick break before we head into the second half of the show to speak with David Nimkin from the National Parks Conservation Association about the Obama administration's recent designation of the Bears Ears National Monument. We'll take a break for a quick underwriter, set of underwriters, and then we'll be back. Stay tuned.
Miller Orthodontics supports KPCW and their involvement with area youth and teens. Speaking of youth, did you know Invisalign has a specific type of aligner just for teens? Over 3/4 of our Invisalign patients are 19 or younger. More information about Invisalign Teen is available at m2ortho.com.
Support for KPCW comes from Crandall Capital with New Park Town Center. With urban amenities and services and home to restaurants, shops, entertainment, lodging, and residences. More information about New Park Town Center at 801-303-5440. Support for KPCW programming has been provided by the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, a nonprofit organization dedicated to protecting Utah's remaining Red Rock Wilderness lands. SUWA and Utah's Red Rock Wilderness need your support now more than ever. To learn more about how you can become involved, please visit the SUWA website at suwa.org.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Renee Bodley.
And during the second half of the show today, we'll be speaking with David Nimkin, the National Parks Conservation Association's Senior Regional Director. We'll be talking about the Obama administration's recent designation of the Bears Ears National Monument here in Utah and giving that some historical context as well as looking forward to what we might expect. David, prior to working at the NPCA, David served as the chief of staff to Salt Lake City Mayor Rocky Anderson, as well as partner at Confluence Associates, a private firm engaged in sustainable development projects throughout the Western United States and Mexico. So he holds deep roots here in the Western region. David, thanks so much for joining us today.
I don't think we've got David on the line now. I think we need to call him again.
Okay.
Stand by, everybody. We will David on the phone in just a second. In the meantime, do we have any underwriters we can go to, Bob? Let's go to some underwriters. We'll be right back with this screener.
Hi, I'm Dana from Recycle Utah. Did you know that plastic takes up to 1,000 years to decompose? This means that unless it has been incinerated, every piece of plastic that has ever been produced still exists on Earth, either in the ocean, on open space, or in landfills. Recycle Utah accepts any kind of plastic for recycling 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Recycle Utah is your community nonprofit recycling center since 1990 and a KPCW supporter.
Hi, this is Andrew Marino with Ski Butlers and proud supporter of KPCW. Ski Butlers delivers skis, snowboards, and accessories to our customers' accommodations in the greater Park City area. What we do would not be possible without the support from our amazing customers, partners, and team members. Ski Butlers is located next to the Marriott on Sidewinder or online at skibutlers.com.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
I'm Renee Bodley, filling in for Chris Cherniak. Sorry about that little stumble there. We were trying to get David Nimkin on the phone. He's with the National Parks Conservation Association. He's the Senior Regional Director. And do we have David on the phone now? David, can you hear us?
Yeah, I do. I hear you. Thank you.
Thanks for being here today. We've got so many questions about this new monument designation here in Utah. Let's start with, did you expect it?
You know, actually we did. It had been a long process. There were a lot of twists and turns, but subsequent to a visit from Secretary Jewell and the leadership of Department of Interior over the summer and the failure of the Congressman Bishop's ill-fated public land initiative that really didn't get through the House and obviously not a realistic proposal, I think we, along with many others, felt that it was inevitable that Bears Ears would be proclaimed.
But we were hearing from Utah's elected leaders, from Governor Herbert and from Representatives Bishop and Chaffetz, that they were talking to the Obama administration as of mid-December, and they were being told that there had not been a decision yet, and there seemed to be a very big push on behalf of Utah leaders to prevent this, what they called midnight monument, from happening. So their efforts didn't succeed. Do you think the Obama administration was determined to do this from the get-go?
I don't think it was from the get-go. I think you would have to take Secretary Jewell at her word that she legitimately was trying to consider a legislative path that might have been public land initiative or something, you know, something similar to that. And so while there was consensus really among all parties that there needed to be some effort to protect this area and give it some sort of special classification or designation, it was pretty clear, really, from the failure of the legislative path that this was going to happen. And so the positioning or posturing by Utah's elected leaders, I think, was just that, was posturing one last final effort to try to dissuade the administration from pursuing this path.
So before we dig in too deep, let's talk a little bit about what this national monument includes. Why is it so important, and why have all these efforts been focused on this particular area? Can you give us an idea of, you know, why this is important to protect?
Yeah, well, first, as part of a general area, it was a proposal that was really absolutely generated by Native American tribes, initially started several years ago by a group called Dene Bekea, Navajo-focused, looking at ways that this administration or a legislative initiated proposal could protect some of their sacred lands and sites. It was, I think, reasonably recognized shortly thereafter that there were other tribes that had particular sacred interests and values for this site, and that was broadened then to include a intertribal coalition, bringing non-traditional allies together, quite honestly. The tribes that are part of this coalition have longstanding differences in places, but agreed on this. And part of that process had looked to elders in the tribes to identify areas, customs, procedures that they would want that would reclaim for them lands that they hold very dear and are sacred and felt that were being abused. At the same time, there were efforts, as your listeners may recall, and you may recall, for what was called the Greater Canyonlands proposal, which was profoundly supported by many conservation groups. At some point, a year or two ago, the two proposals blended together, and there was sort of a common bond between both the Native American community and the conservation community that we're looking at many areas that for many years had been identified in the Red Rocks Wilderness Bill as wilderness study areas, wilderness areas that needed protection. From our perspective, and I'm with the National Parks Conservation Association, for 30 years, NPCA has been advocating for what we call the completion of canyonlands. That canyonlands is the only national park in Utah that was not initially created as a national monument under the aegis of the Antiquities Act and a presidential proclamation. It was created in 1964 by Congress. And if you were to stand up on Grandview Point or at Dead Horse State Park or Hatch Point down in San Juan County and look out over the vastness of Canyonlands, a big part of that area is not, in fact, the park. And as politics often does, they square off the edges. And we've been advocating that the original idea for Canyonlands should be the natural erosional boundaries up to the Wingate Cliffs and other areas. So so for those three areas, those three elements, I think, contribute to the importance. One is the Native American advocacy for this special sacred place that doesn't have special protections. The element of protecting incredible and unique wilderness sites and providing the levels of protections that should be realized there. And from certainly our perspective, what we call the completion of Canyonlands, in this case for Bears Ears, it protects the eastern side of Canyonlands up to those cliffs. It doesn't complete the whole thing, but it's a major share of it. And that's a long-winded explanation. I hope that's helpful.
That was very helpful. Thank you. David, one thing that struck me as I was covering this story in the month of December for KPCW is that when I talk to either the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, or if I talk to Cynthia Wilson with Dene Bakea, or if I talk to Congressman Bishop about this issue, everyone agreed that there needed to be protections in place for this land. Everyone agreed that there were sacred Native American Indian sites there, that there was wilderness that needed to be protected and conserved. And when you look at Bishop's PLI proposal and the actual monument designation and what the Coalition for Bears Ears wanted, they are remarkably similar. But what struck me, the boundaries are similar, but what struck me was the disagreement laid in how to protect the area, whether it was through executive order or a legislative act. And Rebecca Benally, who is a San Juan County commissioner who was quoted frequently by Congressman Chaffetz, she is a Native American, and she was against the monument designation because she felt like you can't trust the federal government. And it's hard to argue with a Native American about why they should trust the federal government. So Do you think that under the executive order, the Native American tribes are going to get the management of these lands that they hope for?
You know, that's obviously a good question. I believe that they certainly will have a much higher level of influence and collaboration through the monument than they would have through what had been represented in a legislative path or the public land initiative. And so as you're talking about executive versus legislative, I would say it's really a function of ownership and influence and control. And I think part of what was embedded in the public land initiative and the legislative proposal was a little bit of a charade that the level of control and management responsibility would be increasingly vested with local interests. And that sounds good on the surface, but it lends itself more and more to the proposals for the state of Utah to take over federal lands. Mm-hmm. It doesn't say that exactly, but it's really about control and it's about influence. And so there's a lot of misunderstanding about, you know, what is contained in the proclamation and in the management of the Bears Ears National Monument. And a lot of that will be determined. There'll be planning that will engage all parties, but with particular attention to the Native American interests. That would not have been the case from my reading of the bill of the Public Land Initiative in that case. So I hope that distinction is apparent to us anyway.
Well, one really interesting example that was given was that the Native Americans will drive on this land to collect some firewood. I think there's something unique about the firewood they get on this land for their ceremonies. And they were concerned that if it was declared a monument, they would no longer be able to take these motor vehicles out into these far reaches of the monument to gather this firewood. And there are many members of the tribe that don't have the physical ability to go out there and walk out there and gather it. And one of the answers was, yes, you will still have a voice in how this land is managed, where you can, I guess, negotiate what kind of access you have to this land and how you get out there. It's really interesting.
Yeah, I think part of what that reflects is, you know, kind of a campaign of misinformation. And I think there has been a lot of that. We certainly have a lot of that in this country, and it certainly plays out, you know, on this issue as well, that, you know, the fear tactics that your, you know, current ability to perform ceremonial acts, to collect herbs and native plants, or firewood will be rescinded or restricted. And I think that's just not the case, because that's really at the core of engaging the Native American community in the co-leadership, collaborative management of this place. It still is federal land. It's still owned by all of us. We all have a stake, whether we live in Park City or Cleveland, as well as San Juan County. And I think we all need to assume that responsibility to assure that it meets the high principles that were established in this proclamation.
Looking a little further back, it seems that Utah has a pretty, has a pretty difficult history with national monuments. There's long been opposition and debate over the additional protections placed on land in Utah. Can you give us a little bit of a synopsis of where that comes from?
Well, I think a big chunk of it comes from the establishment of the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument and the process that was followed in the creation of it. That was in 1996, I believe. And there was misinformation, obfuscation in the creation of that. There was a lot of work being done to protect it. But it really has, 20 years on, you know, created this really bad taste, which is unfortunate, because, as I said earlier, four of Utah's five national parks, as well as our other national monuments managed by the Park Service, were established by executive order. And there are presently you know, at the end of 2016, the numbers aren't in, but there'll probably be close to 13 million people that will have come to visit our national parks and our national monuments, you know, generating probably close to $900 million in visitor spending. It's a huge, huge value. So it doesn't fit that there should be some reluctance to do this. And I think at the time that some of these now national parks were created originally as national monuments, there was some resistance to that. That's not surprising. They're not all uniformly supported and agreed upon. I would say this, too, is that early on in the public land initiative process, the then legislative director for Congressman Bishop and then subsequently chief of staff for Congressman Chaffetz said to me that we're pursuing the public land initiative because we feel there's a responsibility for Congress to do its job. And frankly, if Congress is unwilling or unable to protect the lands, as you said and others have said, that everybody agrees need to be protected, then it should be then the responsibility of the president to create these national monuments. So this came from the legislative director of Congressman Bishop. So in this particular case with Bears Ears, Congress didn't do its job. Congressman Bishop didn't do his job, and it was left to then the president to exercise some forward thinking and assure that this area will be protected.
Would it have been possible for anyone to have accomplished that, though? It just seemed like there were so many diverse interests that had to come to the table. To come up with a consensus or a compromise bill, it means that not everybody, well, pretty much everybody at the table is not going to get exactly what they want. And in this sort of divisive political climate, could anyone have passed a bill like that?
Well, I think that there was a promise, you know, for doing something like that 3 or 4 years ago when this public land initiative was created. It was, you know, at least touted by the press as a, quote, grand bargain. It really wasn't a grand bargain. It was, you know, I would say fairly one-sided. We participated with our eyes open, but clearly with the objective to find that kind of consensus, to find the give and take that might work. We had actually even proposed, as did many others, that we bring in facilitators to help with the process. That was rejected. Ultimately, there was a bill that I think some people could have supported, but it was, I think, contaminated or poisoned by the addition of a lot of really poison pills. You know, so on the ground, you could have found some of the changes, but the bill that came out ultimately had language that would have kind of eviscerated the Wilderness Act and the Clean Air Act. It would have exempted any further Antiquities Act designations. A lot of work we had done on finding balance, and I would use this as an example for energy development on public lands, is the Master Lease Plan in Moab that actually has been a resounding success. And the process that was and the protocols that were established with the master lease planning would have been eliminated in the public land initiative. So it was as if, you know, you might be able to find some agreement on the ground, but when you started adding elements that stripped authority of acts of Congress or presidential authorities or agency rules, it begins to lose some of its appeal.
So looking forward at this point, now that the monument has been officially created, what can we expect to see on the ground, and how quickly will this happen?
Well, it's going to, it's prescribed, and this is all to be determined, and there are going to be, you know, new leaders and players that will be leading Department of Interior and the Bureau of Land Management and the U.S. Forest Service and Department of Agriculture. So it remains to be seen. A lot of the responsibility ultimately to approve the planning process for what will be authorized or not will ultimately flow through the leaderships of those departments. You have that process that will move forward, and I really don't know the time frame for that, but it's we're talking, you know, a couple of years, during which time certain kinds of uses will be curtailed. The other part is the, you know, the rhetoric around removing the authority of the president to have created the park, our attorney general pursuing a mission to, you know, sort of invalidate the proclamation. You know, I'm not a lawyer. I can't establish that. But on very good advice, I think that that's a fool's errand, to tell you the truth. And so I feel that we're in this transitional period where there will be some planning. There may be limits on how rapidly it might proceed, because the funding to do that planning is ultimately vested in Congress. And so there may, in fact, be efforts to minimize that planning process while the backdrop of the litigation or political challenges are going on.
David, are you aware of any plans, any effort to help the people of San Juan County with this transition? One of their county commissioners, a man who's been in the news frequently, Philip Lyman, talked about San Juan County as the 29th poorest county in the country. And so to deny the residents of that county the opportunity to work for an oil company who wants to drill on that land seems very unfair to the citizens of that county. You mentioned earlier the benefits of ecotourism. Will there be any outreach efforts, any training, any education efforts on the ground in San Juan County to help the people who live there understand how this designation could be economically beneficial to them?
I think that would be a wise thing to do. I know that there have been some philanthropic interests in pursuing that. I'm not sure what and how that might play out at this point. You know, I would just say that there is, you know, a great need in our state to find that balance that recognizes and not just pay lip service to the fact that we have an incredible natural resource and cultural resource in this state that deserves protections, and that, in fact, a huge part of our economic well-being is generated not only by tourism but the outdoor industry. I'm sitting here in Salt Lake City, and the OR show, the outdoor retail show, is here, and they bring 20-plus thousand people, you know, twice a year to Salt Lake, in part because of its extraordinary beauty and proximity to Park City and the mountains and waterways. So I think we need to reinforce and not just pay lip service to that value. I think some of our political leadership does pay more lip service to that value than they are willing to offer. There's clear evidence that when you create national monuments, there's no loss of earning power, personal wealth, and income. This has been validated from over the last couple of decades by a group called Headwaters up in Montana, and they've been looking at communities all over the country that are proximate to national parks, national monuments, and they have found that there is no significant change. Relative to San Juan County, I would offer another piece of this, is that a reason why San Juan County is in 29th place in terms of its county economy is that half of the population are Navajo and on the Navajo Nation. And there's no question but that the Navajo population and Native Americans in particular in various parts of the state, throughout the West, in fact, are in great need of real systematic attention to their economic aspirations and their needs. And so, you know, part of this is not just allowing some people in San Juan County to have jobs in the energy sector. And by the way, a lot of the examples, look at North Dakota, that the energy jobs are really people, it's an in-migration, not the people who are necessarily living in the county. But we really do need to build the infrastructure of communities in Blanding and Monticello to accommodate some of the benefits that might accrue from recreation, from tourism, because quite honestly, those resources and that infrastructure does not exist presently. So it's a willingness on the part of the local leadership and the citizens in San Juan County to recognize that this is a future that they need to embrace, they need to value it, and I think over time it will yield results. You can always, you know, create some of these energy jobs, but the legacy that is left is fraught with failure. You can't undo the incredible natural and cultural beauty and resources that we have and expect to reclaim it.
Well, David, we have just a couple minutes left, and we wanted to take some time to talk with you about the National Parks Conservation Association and what you do. So give us an overview of the NPCA and your role in all of this.
Sure. So NPCA is a national organization. We have over a million members and supporters around the country. We're almost 100 years old, created by the first director of the National Park Service in 1919, Stephen Mather. And our mission is to preserve and protect the national parks. That has been vested with the National Park Service, but as federal employees, their advocacy is limited. They're managers. We advocate. And because parks are part of larger landscapes, like Bears Ears, and within Bears Ears you have Glen Canyon, Canyonlands, and Natural Bridges, we work on all matters that affect parks, but these larger landscapes. So that includes looking, and we have been successful in advocating for new regional haze standards directed by the EPA. We've been working on master lease plans. I talked about that in Moab, but we're engaged in doing that in the San Rafael Swell area. I'm the regional director for the Southwest. That includes Arizona, Colorado, New Mexico, and Utah, and we have offices in all four of those states. And so we're working on energy matters in Chaco and Carlsbad and Mesa Verde as well. We work on Colorado River issues and making sure that the environmental and recreational values of the Colorado River system are protected as we face climate change and face increasing drought. So we're really all-encompassing, but drawing upon the great affection and affinity Americans have for national parks to engage public will and political will to make the right choices.
Well, David, thanks again so much for joining us today. That was David Nimkin with the National Parks Conservation Association.
Thank you, David. And thank you, Nell. It's been fun being here on This Green Earth with you.
Yeah, thanks so much for guest hosting today. We want to take a minute to wrap up and thank our sponsors, including Recycle Utah, Republic Services, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, Park City Mountain, and our newest sponsors, Mark Miller Subaru, as well as the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air, Cruise, and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Park City Bike Demos, Kearns Boulevard next to Adolph's, parkcitybikedemos.com. Long, Reimer, Weininger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Thanks again for joining us today on This Green Earth. As always, you can email us your thoughts and ideas for future shows at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org. This is KPCW 91.7 FM Park City. Remember, we've got your Wasatch back.